Welcome to the Deeper Look podcast for Restoration Church. Each week, we're going to take the passage we're looking at on Sunday and ask questions and go deeper in conversation than we would normally have time to in a gathering. We're asking four big questions. What does this tell us about God? What does this tell us about ourselves? How does this help us love our neighbor? And how can we put this into practice? We're following along the narrative lectionary that's taking us from creation to Pentecost, the full redemptive narrative of Scripture. You can find resources, Bible reading plans at restorationlex.com/restoried. Again, thanks so much for listening. Here we go. All right, what's up, Restoration family? Welcome to the Deeper Look podcast and video that we post on Facebook. And I'm Justin, and that's Caleb over there. And we are, if you've never watched or listened, we're in the middle of the narrative lectionary, where we go through the scriptures, kind of the narrative arc of the story of God. The narrative lectionary goes over 4 years, so we get part of it this year. But walking through what's happening in the scriptures and we ask four questions. What's this say about God? What's this say about ourselves? How's this help us love our neighbor? And how can we put this into practice? So first off, we are looking in 1 Samuel chapter 1 this week. And last week we were in Exodus 32. So that's a ton of narrative that that I know on Sunday I will not have time to give, you know, the full weight of what it should, because a lot happens. So very quickly, let me try, before Caleb fills us in on the story today, let me try to recap where we are from there. So Exodus 32, we have, like we talked about, the idolatry last week at Mount Sinai. So the law is given, covenant renewed, and Moses leads the people to the edge of the promised land. Basically, most of the folks that go into the desert don't make it there. They die before they enter the promised land. And so Moses dies. Joshua comes into leadership of Israel. He leads conquest into the promised land. Lots of battles, bloodiness, all that sort of stuff. And then he divvies up the land, if I'm remembering right, getting the order right, divvies up the land to all the different tribes, the promised land. And then Judges comes, the book of Judges, when Joshua dies. And it's a very dark book, because basically everyone forgets the covenant. Everyone forgets God's promise. Everyone turns to their own way. There's a verse, I think it's in chapter 7 of Judges, or 17 of Judges, one of those, where it says that all people are doing what is right in their own eyes. And that's basically what was happening. They're being ruled by a bunch of judges, these tribal leaders, and stuff just gets crazy, spirals out of control. Israel just doesn't look anything different from the rest of the world, and kind of the wickedness and violence and corruption and whatnot. Then you have Ruth, which happens within that context. And then right after that, we get 1 Samuel, which is kind of a turning point in Israel's history, and we are in the very first chapter of that, and talking about someone named Hannah. So Caleb, tell us just as a recap of our story this week as we get into 1 Samuel and what this means for us.
Yeah, so we'll be in 1 Samuel 1 and 2, some select verses out of that, but it's an interesting story. Hannah is barren. She's not able to have a child, and it's caused a lot of anguish for her, kind of the way I've heard it described is just aching from the inside out. So it's not just I'm struggling, it's I'm struggling and it's eating me alive and I don't know what to do with myself anymore sort of thing. So it's just this story of intense struggle, intense anguish. And she's married to Elkanah, I think that's what his name was. I don't know.
That sounds nice.
Elkanah. And one of the things, I don't know if this is in our verses for this week, but and he's trying to comfort her through all this stuff, comfort her with the struggle. And he says, am I not worth more to you than 10 sons? Which was, he's probably trying to be loving, but no, don't ever tell your wife.
Sounds like a husband.
Yeah, like it was just he messed up. As hearing female theologians talk about this versus a bunch of dudes talking about it, it's interesting to hear their insight. He messed up. It was not comforting. But so Hannah has all this pressure. She's got people misunderstanding her. She even has people that are just criticizing her for her barrenness. I mean, this is a time and a place where female strength was signified with your ability to give children. It was a part of your identity. And she's not able to do that. So she's just getting cultural pressure, cultural mistreatment, mistreatment from people in her own family over all this as she struggles with all this stuff. So it's just this, I mean, it's a rock bottom situation for her. Nothing seems to be going right. Nothing seems to be happening. There's no end in sight. She doesn't understand what's going on, why she is the way that she is in this particular story. So she goes to the temple. I don't remember exactly where she went. She goes and she begins praying to God. And kind of a cultural thing is in this time and era, apparently you're supposed to pray out loud. Because if you don't pray out loud, you get accused of what she got accused of by Eli the priest. He thought she was drunk because she was praying and only moving her lips but not saying anything out loud. So, I mean, from top to bottom, it's just like everything is against her. And she prays and she says, God, if you'll give me a child, I'll dedicate him to you. I'll make him a Nazarite, essentially. And God hears that prayer. God answers that prayer. Eli blesses her with that prayer because he sees how serious she is about this. And later on, she has Samuel, who would go on to, I believe, be the last judge of Israel and anoint the first two kings of Israel, which I think was Saul and David. So it's just a story about going from barrenness to having a child, going from struggle to having joy. And one of the things that really sticks out about this particular story compared to a lot of stories in scripture is she doesn't retaliate against those who are giving her a hard time. She doesn't start the character assassination stuff. She doesn't try to get vengeance because people are just giving her grief, and she doesn't act out poorly in any of this. She just has strength and she relies on prayer. And it's actually this really inspiring, gripping story when you get into the emotions of all of it. The world's against me. I'm not going to set myself against the world. I'm going to reach out to God. So that's kind of where we're at right now in this particular story.
Awesome. Yeah. I think this is just, like you said, just a powerful, powerful story. As you get into the emotions of it, as you get into the cultural aspects of it, and really the connection with the rest of the story overall. I mean, she is deeply, deeply wounded by everyone in her life. If I'm remembering right, there's no interaction she has with anyone where someone understands her, truly understands, empathizes with her pain in the entire chapter. And only God is the one who responds to her with grace. And I think that's significant. Culturally, in that time, like you said, childbearing was a sign of blessing, was a sign of strength for women and value. And so the woman who is giving her a hard time is her husband's other wife. I think her name is Peninnah or Peninnah, and she is she has kids. And so going down to offer the sacrifices and then eating there when this very public thing, I'm sure, and she's with the family and has nothing, and the rest of the family looks like God is blessing, is getting blessed by God, and she just, you know, in her bitterness. And then her husband says that, you know, am I not good enough for you, basically. No. And, you know, just the emotional, just absolute unintelligence there for him to not realize and not empathize with what she's actually feeling and trying to fix the situation as most men do.
I'm sure he was probably trying to say something nice, trying to be helpful. It just wasn't helpful.
Yeah.
Not helpful. And to kind of add to some of this, Elkanah's other wife, well, let me take a step back, because there's some relational dynamics here too that are worth exploring. Elkanah gives Hannah twice as much food as he does the other side of the family. But Hannah doesn't eat it because she is just in such anguish all the time. And then you've got the other side of the family who doesn't get as much food as she does. And why doesn't she eat all her food? Why is he giving her more food when she didn't eat it at all? Like, you can hear this conversation happening then. Yeah. I mean, it's just like, oh, man. And you know what? I mean, I'm skipping a little ahead here, but we still kind of do that same thing today. It's like, well, they brought it on themselves. They caused this for themselves. Like, you've got this. If someone is wrestling with something and it's dark, you might say something like, "What? Just cheer up." Like, we still do these sorts of things today. And there's a lot of that going on here, and it's not the right response.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have, on top of that, you have Eli, the high priest, who, you know, is, when you think about a high priest, you want somebody who's standing in the gap between God and man, interceding on people's behalf. And his first step is judgment. His first thing is judgment. And if you continue reading about Eli and his story and his family, you see what a corrupt kind of, you know, a situation there is. And he ends up being very detached. He dies here in a few chapters anyway. But the both sides of this, like her family, and then, you know, someone who's supposed to come with compassion and does not. And there's so many, like, the narrative, the way the narrative ties together. I think about a couple different women who came before Hannah in the story. We have Hagar, who has a baby with Abraham as their way of trying to, you know, to bring about God's promise on their own. And she's abused so much by Sarah. She runs away, and the angel of the Lord ends up ministering to her and calling her back. And she names God, says, "You are the God who sees, you sees me." And then I think about Leah, another marriage of two wives, how she was just felt mistreated within that. And the Bible is really, I think, profound in giving these pictures of women in their faithfulness and making really them the hero of the story, and not because they've conquered an army, not because they have, you know, gained lots of wealth, but because even in the depths of their brokenness, and even in the being misunderstood and mistreated and forgotten in every scenario, family, culture, everything, they show incredible faith and faithfulness to God and prayer. And thinking through that, moving forward, even with Mary, who in the same way has a prayer very similar to Hannah's prayer in chapter 2, in terms of God's turning everything upside down. You know, he's exalting the humble, humbling the exalted. And even into Hebrews, if we don't have a high priest who can't empathize with our weaknesses, but one who was tempted in every way we were, but did not sin, so we can come boldly before the throne of grace. And Jesus is what Eli could not be for someone in their pain. Just so many things that, like, all weave together within the big picture of scripture that I absolutely love. So
yeah, well, there's so much more to this story, but maybe we can get to some of it in our questions. Our first question is, what does this tell us about who God is? So Justin, what do you think?
This is such good news, and what it tells us about God. You know, we've seen from this point this infinitely powerful creator God who does miraculous things, parting the Red Sea, and you would imagine a God of that power and of that majesty would not pay any attention to someone as lowly and hurting as this woman without children. And that's probably what her culture thought. But this God sees and hears people at their lowest, at their breaking point, and their grief and their emotions. And God does not turn away from those who find themselves in this place of sadness. The Psalms 34:18, God is near to the brokenhearted. Like, God's presence is a help in times of trouble. We see that over and over again. And it's a comfort just knowing the character of God, and that He's not just for the people who are the winners, who are the successful. God is near to us when everything is falling apart, when we feel like a failure, when we feel like we're misunderstood, when we can't control the pain and the depression and the anxiety and the sadness that overwhelms us. That is not a sign of God not being near, but we see in this story that God is very near in those moments in our lives that we all will find ourselves in from time to time. So,
yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think for me, as far as what the story tells us about who God is, it tells us that God is the one who steps into struggle. I think a lot of time in our prayer lives, sometimes we just ask for escape. Like, God, take me out of the struggle. Take me out of the struggle. Please let me just quit dealing with all this sort of thing. And it's like, well, wait a second. God actually wants to meet you in the struggle. And it's like, why would a loving God want to meet you in a struggle? Why doesn't God just deliver you instantly? Sort of thing, right? But God meets us in the struggle. One, because he's a resurrection God. He takes the struggle and he can breathe life into it. And that's what he does with this particular story. God takes Hannah's barrenness and breathes life into her literally, to the point that Samuel, her son, would become kind of the turning point between judges and kings in Israel's history. The thing that I bring it up, but I think it's worth talking about, is the story doesn't say that if you pray to God in your struggle that you'll get an answer to that struggle. Like, if I really want to be sensitive, because barrenness is not just a story in scripture. It's a reality that some people deal with, and some people do go on to give birth and some don't. And this is not a story that says if you pray to God, he'll give you a child. That's not what this is. And that's hard. I know you echo the same thing I do. That's hard. There's not a lot of easy answers.
Yeah,
for that.
That's important. It really is, because I don't sense the deepest kind of, you know, lesson in this is like, hey, if you're having a problem, pray and God will make it go away. Because I don't think we see this, that it's happening year after year. It says that Elkanah has been going to sacrifice with his family year after year. I'm sure this wasn't the first recorded prayer, only prayer that Hannah had prayed in the depths of her emotion. And she doesn't. And you don't really even get the sense in the text that it, like, God was like, oh, so now you prayed. Now I'm going to get, like, that's not there. That's just not there.
Yeah, it's not. I think one of the takeaways can be, kind of what I pointed to earlier, though, is God is willing to meet in the struggle, no matter what the struggle is. And that can bring us peace. I think of people with barrenness. I think of people wrestling with addiction or people who have cancer. And sometimes we handle that well and sometimes we don't. I mean, from a pastoral perspective, right? Like that's a reality. Let's not pretend like it's not a thing, because it is.
Yeah.
And Hannah handled this well. I still think she would have handled it well had she not gotten the child, because at this point in her prayer life, there's an obvious reliance on God. And she knows that her husband isn't going to give her an answer. The people around her aren't going to give her an answer. Eli isn't going to be her answer. Only God's going to be her answer, whatever that answer is. And she reaches that point. And one of the things we haven't talked about in the story so far is chapter 2, Hannah's prayer. Her song, really, not her prayer. It's a song of revolution. It's a song about praising the God who lifts up the lowly and takes care of them and tears down those who are arrogant and abuse their power. That's part of it. And it's just this kind of sing-song back and forth thing where it's this God raises those who are lowly, God tears down those who are arrogant or on high, who don't respect things. And there's several verses there. I really encourage you to read chapter 2, the first 10, 12 verses or something like that. But the song ends with this recognition that God is sending a Messiah, that God is sending a king. Again, this is a story about transitioning to kings. And obviously, Jesus is the King of Kings. I mean, this is kind of that turning point. She recognizes that. And I think that's really one of the main points of the story is God will step into the struggle, and it's okay to be in the struggle. I don't have to escape it immediately. What I need to latch on to is that God, Jesus, is the King of Kings, and there is an end to this one day. Yeah. There is hope. And it might be hard now, but God is the God of the resurrection, and God can do some resurrection work here. So again, all that to say, we don't want to be like, hey, if you just pray this thing, then this thing will happen, because that's not what this is. And absolutely. And we don't want to say, it's a hard thing to say pastorally, that it's okay to be in struggle sometimes. Like, it's okay to live in that space and expect for God to show up there, versus if I can just get out of the struggle, then I'll be able to interact with God, because that's not the way life works.
Yeah. There's even, I was thinking, as you said that, there's even a, you know, a, it speaks of that resurrection in verse 6 there. It says, the Lord brings death and gives life. He sends down the Sheol and he raises others up. You get this sense of with death, there is resurrection. And there's not, you know, in this scenario, there's not a, everything's tied into a nice, pretty bow. And in a sense too, it's kind of a prophecy of what will come with the kings, and as the story is introduced with Saul, who exalts himself, and he ends up having a very you know, tragic death, and then David, who is in this, at least in this point in the story, is humble, and God raises him up to where you know, as she prophesied. Of course, it's a prophecy looking forward to Jesus, obviously, too. But even looking just ahead in 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel, you see what her words come to pass for sure. So
yeah,
that's good.
What's our second question?
Second question is, what does this tell us about ourselves? What's this tell us about our identity as image bearers, as followers of Jesus? What does this story tell us?
I think the thing it points to for me, and I can only speak for myself. I can't really speak for everyone else, but I can speak for myself, is I think I can see myself on both sides of the story. I can see myself on the having struggled with things and calling on God to meet me in my struggle, and God meeting me in my struggle. Like, I can see that part of it. I think that's true for everyone, but true in my own life. But I also see the character assassination side of some of this stuff. Like, it's so easy to, when someone else is dealing with a problem, especially if I disagree with that problem or think they brought that problem on themselves, it's easy to, as a human, go, well, it's your fault, you caused it. You brought this on yourself, sort of thing. And I think that's true for everyone. I think all of us have that thing of, if you'd quit being an idiot, things would get better. Or if you'd quit crying about it, things would get better, sort of thing. I think that's kind of true across the board. And I mean, gosh, nothing new under the sun. This is several thousand years ago, this particular story. And we're still doing it. We're still doing the same exact things.
Yeah.
So it's our story. And the way that God comes into it is, I'm willing to come into the struggle. Kind of just going back to that.
Absolutely. And having done this pastor stuff for going on 16 years, like I've walked through some really dark stuff with people and gone through some dark stuff myself too, but walking through it with other people, you see and you hear over and over again, like, this is awful, but I remember in those moments how much I felt the presence of God, whether it be a death or sickness of a family member or all sorts of things. Like, I've had people say to me constantly, I felt God in that time of trouble more than maybe I ever have in my entire life. So Yeah, I would add, what does this say about ourselves? I totally agree. Like there are moments when we find ourselves like Hannah, where we do feel misunderstood and forgotten, and can't do anything about it. And I know for me personally, like one of the things that I struggle with the most is like, I want to be heard. Like I want, you know, and there's been plenty of arguments marriage wise for, you know, because of this, like mm-hmm. I feel loved if like I can vocalize what I'm really, and I have the ability to do that. Hannah did not have the ability to have understanding in her moment. And there's many people today like her that can't just pull themselves up by their bootstraps and get it figured out and yeah. be understood and don't have a voice to make others understand where they are. And it's humbling to me to know that, there are moments when in this life we will be misunderstood and forgotten and looked over and we can't do anything about it. But in those moments, God sees us. God hears us. God understands. God empathizes. God walks with us. He's near to us in that. And at the same time, like I was immediately convicted reading this, thinking about all the different times I've been dismissive or apathetic or misjudged people in places like this because I'm standing in a position of privilege or I'm just so caught up in maybe like Eli in the ministry or things like that, or the yeah. expectations of these yeah. sort of things that I totally miss reality because I'm not willing to step into it with her. Neither her husband nor Eli was willing to enter into the pain with her. They only gave her answers. Mm-hmm. And God stepped into that pain with her. And so as a pastor, as a follower of Jesus, I think that's what compassion calls for us, is to not start with judgment and then with, you know, pithy answers, but be willing yeah. to step into the brokenness of others' lives, which really, I mean, it kind of begins the answer there to our next question, which is, how does this help us love our neighbor? So jump off from there. What do you think this does to help us love yep. our neighbor?
When I read this story, I think to myself, I want to be like Hannah. It's almost like this elementary kid answer to this, but it's like, I want to be like her. She was really struggling. Again, literally aching from the inside out, weeping bitterly in anguish, is the way the text describes it. And man, it would just be so easy to rip off people's head who rub me the wrong way if I felt like that. And she doesn't do that in this passage. I mean, it's just this continual, nope, I love you, goes to God. And I'm like, that's commendable. Like, that's honorable. That's a life worth living sort of thing. And I'm a lot better than I used to be, but I still got a temper. When it comes out, it comes out. It's like, Caleb, shut it down. And like this story, reading this story, it's like, okay, I want to be like Hannah. She didn't let her temper get out of control. She didn't let anger get out of control. She didn't go after revenge or after didn't hold malice towards the people that were around her. It was, I'm going to cry out to God. This sucks and it hurts, but I'm going to lean on God. And I think that pattern probably made all the difference in her life. And so as far as loving my neighbor, it's like, okay, I got to do the same thing. It's one thing to love my neighbor when I'm in a good mood. When I'm in a bad mood, I need to be like Hannah. And I'm not saying that's easy. Like, I think that's a God thing, a God transformation thing that God has to do in your life. But it kind of harkens to Jesus saying, love your enemies. And I'm sure she felt like she had some enemies in this particular yeah. time. Of no choice of her own, people who just had set themselves against her because of her situation.
That's good, yeah. I think, you know, the cliche saying is, you know, the be kind because everyone you meet is facing a hard battle. But that it's a cliche because it's true. Like it's
yeah,
you have everyone you're encountering right now is facing something, and they may respond in a way not like Hannah, maybe through, you know, they may be lashing out in anger, their bitterness. There's some sort of response that's growing out of the pain that they're experiencing or have experienced before. And I think of conversations I've had with teachers about, you know, the problem students and how you can always figure out pretty soon that it's a family issue at home, like that they're hurting, that there's a struggle and it's causing them to lash out in those ways. And so I think just loving our neighbor and knowing when we find ourselves and our neighbors in these moments of weakness, lashing out even against us, that it's coming from that same place of pain, of some experience of hurt that they have or have had that is growing us out. And that hopefully gives us some grace and the ability, like we said, to step into it with them and to listen to those emotions and
move forward. Yeah, and expect God to show up.
Yep.
I mean, at the end of the day, that's all we can really do is we can do the loving part, but we can't do the fixing part. And God's got to show up. So, I mean, it's a faith thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So last question, how do we put this into practice?
This particular story, man, I'm going to lean on, First Samuel 2, I'm going to lean on her, I call it her revolution song. I mean, it's the song of a revolutionary or almost the song of a fighter or a soldier. It's kind of weird. I think sometimes we don't like to think about those on high who are abusing power being torn down, or we think about it in such a way that it's like, well, I just want you to be crushed. No, we want God to level the playing field, to bring people up that are wrestling, that are suffering, to correct, which I think is probably the more, the better understanding of this, to correct this misuse of power and social things to oppress people, like in this particular story. It's like, practice that in prayer. God, lift these people up. That are really wrestling with this. Lift me up if you're really wrestling with it. Ask God to lift you out of that situation, to meet you in that situation, but to lift you out of that situation. And being willing to pray those sorts of things, because that's what this is. This song is a prayer about those exact things, and it ends with basically our saying, come Jesus. That's what's going on here. So I think that's the way we practice that this week. We go to God in prayer, even in our struggle, expecting God will show up in some form or fashion that'll bring us peace, and to have this own song in our own hearts of, yeah, God, level things, make things right, is maybe the absolute best way to put that. Make things right. Pray for it.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I heard somebody say one time how, you know, we as modern Western folks, we haven't particularly liked the idea of God being a judge. But if you understand stories like this and lives of people who have been under oppression and who have not had the type of lives that most of us have had, and maybe in, you know, third world countries, and both of us have been there and seen these sort of things, that there's a celebration that God is a judge and will one day put the world to rights. And that is good news, especially for the oppressed. And maybe we have to ask the question, are we uncomfortable with the idea of God being the judge because we subconsciously know that we might be the one
being leveled
in judgment? Yeah. I mean, and that can be big picture culturally, but in some cases, even personally. And to know and to understand, I just find that so much, like you said, knowing kings and rulers and all the things that's happening, it is good news that God will come as judge and put the world to rise. That is such good news.
Yeah. And that's what Hannah believed. I mean, that's her song. That's the heart of her prayer. That's what she believed in. She lived it out, especially in the way she treated those around her who were mistreating her. Yeah. I mean, this story is so multifaceted. Yeah. We can spend hours on all this stuff.
Totally. Yeah, I'd add, as far as putting it into practice, the one thing that I really feel like hammering in on is her faithfulness in prayer is really tied to her emotions. And there's certain emotions that some of us have been taught are that we should not bring before God. Mm-hmm. That we should put on a happy face, that we should not be angry. To use the language of the Examine and some stuff that Pete Scazzaro in Emotionally Healthy Spirituality has talked about, to really take an honest, look at our emotional life and allow God to meet us in the reality of those emotions, like Hannah did. She did not, from what we can tell at least, dry up her tears and walk into the temple with a smile on her face.
And I hate to interrupt you. I'm going to interrupt you for just a second. What you're talking about is exactly what Eli does to Hannah. She's not praying like a normal person.
Yeah.
She's moving her lips without saying anything out loud, and she's like bawling her eyes out. Is she drunk? Just bring it all before God, no matter what it is. So sorry to cut you off, but
that's good.
Part of that story.
Yeah, I remember I drove by a church a few years ago, and on the front door window of the church, it said, "Smile, you're at church," like a big sign. And I just thought, man, what does that say to those of us who have, family member going through cancer, or just went through a divorce, or, are going through struggles with our kids? Like, faithfulness to God means the openness of our emotional state, where we really are, in prayer and devotion to God and bringing that to Him. I remember Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe, a couple guys I've been really influenced by, discipled by, like to say that God only meets us in reality, because He's such a real God. He will only meet us in our reality. And that repentance is agreeing with God about that reality. And these emotions are where we really are. And so if God is the God who He says He is, He will meet us in those emotions and help us mind down and express those to Him and lament, as so much of the Psalms do, and experiencing His presence within it, not in fixing it, but within the pain that we will feel in our lives. And so I think just putting it into practice by this week, saying, okay, what am I feeling right now? And what do these feelings say about the way I see God and the way I see myself? And how God, can you give me truth instead of what may be influencing me to be this way? Lord, help me see myself the way you see me, the way you saw Hannah. Mm-hmm. Help me see myself the way you see me, and help me see you the way Hannah saw you as well. So just an examination, honest kind of look inward, examine of where we are emotionally, and allow that to fuel us in prayer. One last thing there, like it says, she tells Eli, "I'm praying from my anguish and grief," not through it, not around it, not in spite of it. She says, "I'm praying from it," like it's growing out of. Like, her prayer is not a response to it or anything. Like, it's literally the guttural response to her anguish and grief is prayer. And I think that's where we need to get. Notice and pay attention to our emotions and let prayer flow out of what we are feeling in intimacy with God.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, and I think when we do that, it's easier, or maybe we're more aware is the better way to put it, we can become more aware of the God of the resurrection when we get to that state, because we go from God changed my emotions to God, can you breathe life into me through these emotions? Can you take this death I'm feeling and transform it into life?
Yes.
Not just not wipe it off the face of the earth. Like, that's not what resurrection is. It's taking that thing that's dead and actually flipping it upside down in a way to bring life to you. And the only way that you can do it is by embracing it. Like, yeah. Can't just throw it to the side and pretend like, I'm this new thing. No, that's not how resurrection works.
Yes.
That's not how it works. So yeah, that's a good word, dude.
Yeah, I'd say too, just I'm keep adding things on, but like, I don't want to communicate that this means if you're not crying and weeping in prayer, that you're not like, cause for me, like the, what I need to pay attention to is not usually like tears, it's numbness. And so sometimes it's paying attention to the lack of emotion and not the emotion in general. Like, why do I feel so numb? And bringing that to God, like, what has dried up within me that I am this numb to my own reality and emotion and circumstances around me? So it's going to look different for everybody. It's just paying attention to where you are and meeting God in there in prayer. So
yeah, that's good.
What's been real? This is a good story.
That's all I've got for now. Yeah.
Every week we always, there's always something we forget about afterwards that, because these stories are so big. So if you're watching or listening and you read this, it's first Samuel 1 and 2, read both chapters there and just get the full picture of the story. And if you have questions or comments or you see things that we're missing or question, you know, all that sort of stuff, you can comment there on Facebook if you want to for this video, or you can email us justin@restorationlex.com or caleb@storied.org, and we would love to interact with you about this.
Yeah,
these stories are so life-giving when we dig deeper, and that's why we're doing this podcast. So we love you guys, and we will be talking about this on Sunday with Restoration. You can also check out Caleb's video, which will be coming at storied.org, on this story as well. And so any closing thoughts there for
closing remarks? Here's my closing remark. If I could wrap all of this up into just one sentence, it would start with the question, what's Hannah's commentary on all of this? And her commentary on all of this is what she names her son Samuel, which means God heard, God hears.
Boom.
Yeah.
Way to end it out. So, all right, guys, thanks for listening and watching. We will see you next week.
Peace.